There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind, but they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ, and you are just the person to give it to them. So I invite you to connect with us online. We're at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, sign up for the email newsletter. We'll send you lots of information and additional commentary that we don't have time to share here in the hour on the show. We'd also appreciate it if you would like The Reconnect on Facebook and let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends. I'm going to lead off today with actually a piece that was on the front page of the New York Times this past Sunday. And so, you know, if you're not a New York Times reader, subscriber, you may have seen it just staring back at you from the rack at Starbucks, because I got to tell you, it was an awfully big picture of an African-American pastor in his robed regalia looking quite sternly out at all of us above the headline, "Religious Liberals Sat Out of Politics for 40 Years. Now they want in the game." The subhead, and the article's by Lori Goodstein, the subhead is this: faith leaders whose politics fall to the left of center are getting more involved in politics to fight against President Trump's policies. Okay, now I would just like to say this at the outset. As a person who has been engaged from the conservative religious perspective now for, well, a fairly long time, almost 30 years, I just want to say this. Okay, the religious left has not been uninvolved in politics for 40 years. They've actually been winning. Okay, there's a whole book about it. It's entitled "Why Liberals Win the Culture Wars Even When They Lose Elections." There's a whole book about it. You can read it. It's by Stephen Prothero. He's been on the show. Here's what I got to say. Okay, if you actually think that the religious left has not been involved in politics for the past 40 years, then you're not paying attention. So that's no slant to those who suddenly think that these religiously minded folks on the left who are now asserting themselves in the public sphere or into the public debate or into the political arena, and that's not to say that maybe these aren't interesting new characters or relatively new characters on the scene, but it's not as if there haven't been characters on the scene. It isn't as if the left, the religious left in particular, has not been seeking to advance their cause at all layers of governance for generations. Okay? So if you are a person who has had any participation whatsoever in mainline Christianity, you know, every mainline denomination has a Washington office. They participate in something called ecumenical advocacy days. They train people at the community level for community organizing. Hey, this is our shtick, right? This is what the mainline does. And yes, the mainline is historically the religious left. So really what's going on is not so much that suddenly the religious left has woken up and wants to involve itself in politics. What's really going on is that the impact and the power and the influence of those who are religious and on the left, their influence is diminished because, frankly, the left is now secular. So it's that the left is really, frankly, not particularly interested in a religious viewpoint, not particularly interested in the input and certainly not the leadership of religious people. Here's the other complicating factor for those on the quote-unquote religious left who want to assert themselves in the political arena today. The left, they pretty much got their thing going on, and it's secular. Okay. So if you read through the article, here are a couple of things that you're going to find. Again, this is a front page New York Times article from Sunday. So the Sunday edition of the New York Times, it's no small thing to have your story be the above the fold full page of the New York Times. So this piece was considered by the New York Times to be like stunning, revelatory news that everyone needed in the whole country. The second paragraph is this: across the country, religious leaders whose politics fall to the left of center and who used to shun the political arena are getting involved and even recruiting political candidates to fight back against President Trump's policies on immigration, healthcare, poverty, and the environment. Okay, so there you have it. There's a political agenda that is looking for advocates. There's a political agenda looking for advocates. And that political agenda is finding advocates in what the secular left finds surprising places: religious communities. So if you scroll down even to the next paragraph, the walk-off of which is this, these left-leaning faith leaders are hungry to break the right's grip on setting the nation's moral agenda. Okay, let's just pause right there. The religious right is not setting the moral agenda of America. If anyone is paying attention at all, our culture is drifting at every single measurable point to the left on every single measurable issue, except the issue of abortion. Okay? So if the only thing you're measuring is the temperature of, let's say, millennials and those who are younger than millennials, if the only thing you're measuring is the temperature they have on the issue of abortion, then you're right. The right is winning. The right is winning the culture war. If you're measuring anything else, the culture has shifted in measurable ways to the left. And so this notion that the right has a, quote, grip on setting the nation's moral agenda is just pure foolishness. It's pure foolishness. The very next sentence is this: frustrated by Christian conservatives' focus on reversing liberal successes in legalizing abortion and same-sex marriage. Okay, let's just pause right there. If there have been liberal successes legalizing abortion and same-sex marriage that conservatives view as needing to be reversed, then how is it possible that there's been no effort by anyone on the left to promote these moral agendas, abortion and same-sex marriage? It's absurd on the face of it to say that the left has not been involved in politics for the last 40 years, and then to say, oh, the liberals have had these successes in legalizing abortion and same-sex marriage that the conservatives are working to reverse. And therefore, now the religious left wants people to turn instead into, you know, to what they view as fundamental biblical imperatives. Here's the language: fundamental biblical imperatives. Now you got to turn back there two paragraphs to remember what the political agenda is here. The political agenda is immigration, healthcare, poverty, and the environment. Now you're going to get the fundamental biblical imperatives that are going to be the agenda of the religious left. Okay? And then you're going to get to the real issue, and here it is. I mean, Lori Goodstein, she notes it right here, that their goal is to change some minds about what it means to be a believer. If you were looking for the clear small g gospel here, because this is not the gospel of Jesus Christ, this is the gospel of the religious left. Okay? If you were looking for the proclamation of the gospel of the religious left, here it is. They're trying to change your mind about what it means to be a believer. They're trying to change your mind about what it means to be a believer. They're trying to introduce what they understand to be fundamental biblical imperatives, and those are, by the way, divorced from the saving gospel of Jesus Christ. In fact, this doesn't have to be Christian at all. And here's the confusing part of the article to me. Many of the people quoted are Christians. They even describe themselves as evangelicals. They are African American. And so historically, they come out of very evangelical traditions. However, this is a movement, Goodstein notes, this is a movement of women, gays, activist Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, and Buddhists. And yes, those on the left of Christendom. Okay? So when she talks about who's working together here on the religious left, you need to absolutely note that this is not a reference to Christians. This is a reference to people whose religious views or even non-religious views lead them to the same place on policy agenda items. And so I just think that's what you need to note when you read articles like this. So what I don't want you to do is think that there is suddenly an uptick in left-leaning Christians across the country getting involved in politics. Because in fact, the reverse is true. Liberals are abandoning the Christian faith altogether. It doesn't line up with their view of the world. Okay, Christian doctrine, the teachings of the Bible, don't line up with what they believe politically. And so if you have to abandon either your God or your form of government, your government as God, I got to tell you, when it comes to the liberal mindset, it's God who gets abandoned. So the evidence bears that out. You might remember that we talked to Daniel Cox of PRRI here on the show a while back. He had an article posted back in April called Don't Bet on the Emergence of a Religious Left. I think that's an article that you might want to revisit and an interview you might want to revisit. I'm sure you can grab that podcast from us at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Again, Daniel Cox. I think I talked to him back in April. All right, here's one of the things that he says. Look, nearly half of liberals, so 49% of liberals under 30 are religiously unaffiliated. Now, that means that's numerically more people than everyone who belongs to all Christian denominations combined. Okay, so when we're talking about the left, we're basically talking about non-religious people. We're not talking about religious people, which, if you read the New York Times front page article from this past Sunday, and you read it carefully, you're going to see that. Jim Wallace, who's a guy who heads an organization called Sojourners, and they have a publication by that same name, that's a political activist, left-leaning religious group that started in the 1960s. So, by the way, has been active for the 40 years during which, supposedly, the religious left has not been politically active. So just take note. Sojourners has certainly been active during that time period and is definitely left and is definitely religious. Wallace, in this article, says this: most progressive religious leaders I talk to, almost all of them feel dissed by the left. Now, he's making a distinction there between progressive religious leaders and the left. So when he says the left, he's talking about the political left. And then he goes on to say this: the left, meaning the political left, is really controlled by a lot of secular fundamentalists. There's some new lingo for you. If you were looking for the language that we need today to describe the leadership of the left, and we're talking about the political left, there it is, secular fundamentalist. You're saying to yourself, I can't use the term fundamentalist in that way. Fundamentalist means something very specific to me. It means a period of time during which the fundamentals of Christianity were what defined a particular group of people over and against the modernist, right? They were the threat. Okay, here's the deal. A person can be a fundamentalist for a lot of different religious viewpoints. In fact, we talk about Islamic fundamentalism. Okay, we talk about fundamentalists in various and sundry ways. What Jim Wallace is saying is there are secular fundamentalists for whom secularism is the religion. And the secular fundamentalists are the ones driving and leading the left, driving and leading the political left today. And so when Lori Goodstein says that the religious left is trying to get back into politics, it's not the right they're fighting against. It's the secular fundamentalists who are leading the effort on their own side. So it's an interesting conversation to be privy to. And I would say that if you are a person who would regard yourself as on the religious right of one form or another, It's an interesting conversation to view a little bit from the outside. It's definitely a conversation in which you want to engage with those who are under 50. So people under 50, largely non-religious in our culture. It's definitely a conversation in which you want to engage with people who care about these particular issues, people who care about immigration, people who care about the environment. And I'm not saying that Christians on the right don't care about these things. I actually think that some of these agenda items have been co-opted in a way that is unfortunate. And I actually think that there's some of the folks who identify as on the religious left who are genuinely evangelical. But because we on the right have given those issues away, we've pushed those people to the other side of the political aisle. So I actually think there's some bridge building possibilities here. And I think there's a little Red Rover, send Bobby on over that could happen in the coming weeks, months, years, as folks recognize that to be a Christian and have a biblical worldview does not necessarily mean that your policy positions line up specifically with either political party. All right, that'll probably get me into trouble with some of you. Okay, some of you are saying right now, well, what about my pastor? How do I know where my pastor stands on these things? Does my pastor have any influence? Because obviously the people who are highlighted in the New York Times front page article are all pastors, right? They are leading religious communities of one variety or another. Well, this is a super duper interesting survey that was actually just released. This just posted yesterday. This is by some smarty pants folks at Harvard and Yale. And the article is this: your rabbi, probably a Democrat. Your Baptist pastor, probably a Republican. Your priest, well, who knows? This is about the party registration of religious leaders. So this is a little research project. Apparently, it's not too hard to find out who the ordained people are in this country who are actually serving religious congregations. And so these two researchers identified 180,000 clergy and matched more than 130,000 of them to their voter registration records. So first of all, I didn't even know that you could like do such a thing, but there you go. Apparently this is all a matter of public record. So we got researchers Aiden Hirsch, formerly a political scientist at Yale, and Gabrielle Molina, a graduate student at Harvard, who did this project, identifying 180,000 clergy who are serving religious congregations in the United States and matched 130,000 of them to their voter registration records. Well, guess what the research shows? Well, it's not too hard to guess the political affiliation of your pastor or your religious congregational leader simply based on what kind of congregation they serve. So here you go. Leaders and congregants of Unitarian and African American Methodist Episcopal churches are overwhelmingly, I'll let you guess, Democrat. And those who are Reform or conservative Jewish synagogues are also overwhelmingly Democrat. Those who are serving evangelical and Baptist churches, I'll let you guess, overwhelmingly Republican. So if religious denominations were states, so says their research, almost all of them would be considered safely Democratic or safely Republican, with relatively few swing states involved. So the higher you go up in terms of the where these ministers serve in the hierarchy of their denominations, the more liberal they become. But I think that as a person who knows a lot about mainline Christianity, I would offer up this to our researchers at Yale and Harvard. At least in the Presbyterian Church USA, we actually now have more people who are ordained as specialized clergy than we have clergy serving actual congregations. So there are more ordained PCUSA clergy out there in the country doing, in my view, often mischievous things, working for political action committees, working for the shadow, deeper, what are we calling them now? Deep state business. They all left the PCUSA to go to work for the Obama administration, and they still have jobs. So there you go. Somebody's paying their freight, and they're not actually serving congregations. Why not? Well, because most congregations don't want them, don't want the theology they're espousing, and don't want their politicking from the pulpit. And, you know, I guess not least of which, they're not really pastors. Okay? So there are a lot of ordained clergy out there across the country who I can guarantee you are registered Democrats who aren't actually serving congregations. And so I actually think the numbers are probably far worse than this Yale and Harvard study indicates. Now, how does that influence the congregants? Well, apparently the influence is all one direction. If you have a pastor who is a registered Democrat, over the course of time, your congregation moves in that direction on their views. Now, the only difference is, apparently, if you're Catholic. Apparently, Catholics end up with the kinds of priests that actually match the constituency of their congregation. I thought that was sort of an interesting caveat of the research. All right, we have a lot to cover today. I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to bring you an update on the Cosby trial, that maybe we will have an outcome of that today. I'm hoping that we might know something about the Jeff Sessions testimony before the U.S. Senate as we're talking today. But in the minutes we've got remaining here before the break, let me just lift up this one interesting cultural conversation. Now, this is a cultural conversation that I'm just going to stick it under the category of systemic delusion. We have reached the point of system-wide, nationwide delusion on the issue of transgenderism. Okay, it's time for us to say so. It's time for us to say that articles that refer exclusively to a man who is genetically a man, and every reference to this individual uses female pronouns, and talks about this man as if this man is a woman, we have reached a point of systemic delusion. We now share this delusion nationwide. Here's the article from this one. This is the version of it by CNN. I read a version of it from the Portland paper just a few days ago. But here's a sentence. Reese, a transgender man who is expecting a baby with his male partner of 7 years, Biff, the Portland, Oregon couple will welcome a son in July. Now, a previous generation would have recognized the delusional nature of what's going on here. This man, whose name is Tristan Reese, was born a woman. Now, the article says, was assigned the female gender at birth. No, that's ridiculous. Do not participate in the delusion any longer by reading sentences like that and not stopping and saying that from a biblical and a Christian worldview, that is nonsense. Okay? He says, which is just ridiculous because this is a woman. Says he kept his original parts. Okay, keeping his original parts means he has a uterus. And if he has a uterus, he's a woman. And so at some point, somebody needs to say so. Well, you say, God has said so, because after all, this man who thinks he has a uterus is now almost full-term pregnant with a baby boy. Let's just be perfectly clear. A man cannot be nearly full-term pregnant with a little boy. Now, what I do like is the pro-life nature of this article, where they go ahead and describe that baby that's in that womb as a baby. They go ahead and describe the baby in the womb as a boy. They anticipate having a son. So I don't know what the feminists are going to do with the transgender movement, but here's the paragraph that if you as a parent want to have a conversation about the systemic nationwide delusion we are suffering as a people, here's the paragraph for you. This is a quote by the pregnant person. I'm okay with my body being a trans body. I'm okay being a man who has a uterus and has the capacity and capability of carrying a baby. I don't feel like it makes me any less of a man. I just happen to be a man who's able to carry a baby. At some point, we have to say, no, you're not. At some point, we have to say, that is not who you are. And we as a culture are not going to participate in your personal delusion. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. You can give me your feedback at reconnectwithcarmen.com or on Twitter at Carmen LaBerge. Hey, we'll be right back. friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about. We're trying to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We certainly invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. While you're at the website, I'd appreciate it if you'd sign up for the email list. You could actually, you know, start getting this as a podcast so that you can share it with other people. It'd just be great to be in an ongoing conversation with you and to equip you in whatever way we can to get God back into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. So that's really our goal. Again, the website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. All right, I want to bring you up to date on just a couple of breaking news stories, or actually they're sort of, you know, ongoing news stories that there's some breaking information or not so much breaking information in. All right, first of all, in the Cosby ongoing trial in Pennsylvania, just to bring you up to date on that, the jury is still deliberating. For those of you who aren't terribly familiar with this case or this situation, so Bill Cosby has been on trial in Norristown, Pennsylvania, in the Montgomery County Courthouse since, the jury deliberated 4 hours on Monday and back in deliberations today. The trial's been going on for a few weeks. Bill Cosby is 79 years old. He's nearly blind, for those of you who haven't been keeping up with things. He's been in the courthouse every single day. He did not take the stand in his own defense, which is probably wise in this circumstance. And what's at stake here is Andrea Konstad, who said that Mr. Cosby drugged and sexually assaulted her at his home outside Philadelphia in 2004. And this is one of those stories that maybe if it had not been for social media, if it had not been for somebody tweeting out during a comedy routine something that then sort of took on a life of its own via social media, this now dates back a couple of years, and suddenly there were all of these people who came forward and said, this is an experience that I had with Bill Cosby as well. And so I just know in my own circle of friends and even in our family, sort of how devastating and shattering it was to find out that a person who, you know, we thought was one thing may very well be a very different person who has done things that, you know, are reprehensible. And so I think that in terms of a Christian worldview, in terms of a biblical worldview, you know, redemption is always possible, but confession is a part of that. And these are certainly not things for which Mr. Cosby has taken any personal responsibility or offered any, you know, sense of public confession. And so I just set that before you in terms of a point of conversation that we would be having with other people, because this is headline news. And my guess is that this is a conversation topic in lots of places where you find yourself. And so how you enter into conversations about those who are accused of wrongdoing, who have at least publicly put forth a different viewpoint of those events than the accuser, and then where these processes play out in front of all of us, and where the public persona that we have known may be in fact very, very different than the character of the person behind the scenes. So we have some biblical references to which we can point. I mean, certainly King David, who's recognized as a man after God's own heart, was also a horrendous sinner. And yet he does come to a point of deep confession. Psalm 51 is this testimony, this confessional testimony of David about the depth of his sin. David also has in his life a really, really important person. And that important person's name is Nathan. And each and every one of us, no matter who we are, particularly people who have high public profiles, who frankly think they're untouchable, who believe they are living above the law or beyond the law, no one needs a Nathan in their life more than a person of power. When we talk about speaking truth to power, we're talking about the kind of person that the prophet Nathan was. First of all, you have to be close enough to the person in power that you can speak with authority into their life. And then you need to be a person whose absolute allegiance is to the Lord your God without concern that the person in power may lop off your head if they don't like what they hear you say. So, when you think about people in positions of power today and the people who surround them, we need to be praying for Nathans to be in the lives of those powerful people. And if God has placed you in such a position, if you are God's Nathan in the life of a person of power, then I want you to be encouraged today to have your absolute allegiance be unto the Lord your God. Absolute allegiance to the Lord our God. Even if it may cost you significantly and dearly to speak the truth to power. All right, I'm going to move on to the other big ongoing news of the day. And this is what's happening right now. Our Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee. That's been going on now for about an hour. His testimony is related to the Senate Intelligence Committee's inquiry into Russia's meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Senators are asking the Attorney General about why he recused himself from that inquiry. They're asking about the communications that he had with the Russians during the campaign. They're asking about his relationship with now-fired FBI Director James Comey. And so, just as a reminder of how we got here, the Justice Department opened an original investigation into Russia's meddling in our election and possible ties to the Trump campaign. And as the leader of the Justice Department, the Attorney General decided to recuse himself from the investigation because, frankly, he was a surrogate for Trump during the campaign. And so it's a little bit, you know, you're going to be at some point the subject of part of the investigation, and you can't be the person overseeing it. So that's what he told the Senate today, that he felt most appropriate to step aside due to his role in the campaign. He said that he has not since then been briefed on the investigation. And yet, in the midst of the investigation, you all know this, the head of the FBI, Director James Comey, was fired. Trump stated clearly that he fired Comey because of the Russia investigation. Comey testified last week before this same Senate Intelligence Committee, and in that testimony, new questions were raised about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' actions and the role that he may have played. So, now the investigation has is really under the purview of a special prosecutor. And you're probably hearing about, you know, all kinds of questions related to that as well. Senators want to know what Jeff Sessions knew and when he knew it, and that's what they are seeking to discover in today's conversation in the Senate Intelligence Committee. So if anything comes out of that, we'll certainly talk more about it tomorrow. All right, I want to head to, I want to cover two stories quickly about Ramadan. So Ramadan is the month we're in, by the way. We happen to be in the Muslim month of Ramadan. Okay, so we've talked about this from one viewpoint already because there has been a rise in Islamist attacks, Islamist terrorist attacks during what is supposed to be a holy month of Ramadan. And so I want to lift up to you a couple of stories that are also related to Ramadan, but take a different tact. So this is out of North Carolina. A county in North Carolina, Mecklenburg County, which for those of you who are listening who have a sense of history, Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, is a historically very reformed Christian place. So Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, by action of its county commissioners, adopted a resolution on Tuesday, 6 in favor and 3 against, declaring May 26 to June 24 as, quote, the month of Ramadan. Here is part of the resolution. Ramadan is a sacred time that commemorates the revelation of the Quran to the Prophet Muhammad and encourages fasting, prayer, reflection, God consciousness, and gratitude. The resolution goes on. Each day of fasting teaches the soul to struggle with the self, persevere, be patient, forgive, and love. Now, all of that is adopted right out of some forms of Muslim theology. Not all forms would say the same thing about Ramadan, but that's where they're getting this information. So the resolution goes on to assert that Islam is a part of America's history and that Muslims should be recognized for their contributions. And then I'll quote again. Ramadan reminds us that Islam has always been a part of America, and Muslims have made extraordinary contributions to our country. Okay, Ramadan has nothing to do with any of that. But anyway, that's what the resolution says. It says, including those made by the famous Muslim scholar Oman Ibn Said, who was enslaved and brought to the Carolinas in 1807. Why this is relevant to this particular resolution in Mecklenburg County, still a little unclear to me. You can read the full resolution online if you just Google Mecklenburg Ramadan, and it will all pop up. Here's why I bring this to you, because it's really unusual. It's actually really unusual for any governmental body in the United States of America to declare anything, the month of anything, that is related to a particular religion. Why is that? Well, because the Constitution says that the government is not supposed to, right? Preference any religion. It's not. There's not supposed to be a religion preferenced by the government. This is actually the historic understanding of the separation of church and state. So it would not surprise you that lifting concern about this would be the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So this Wisconsin-based Freedom From Religion Foundation, we often lift up their statements because they are generally, attacking every and all religious expression of any kind in any place by anyone. And so it doesn't surprise me that they would show up in this article about the declaration of Ramadan being, you know, the month. And they make some, I think, points that we should consider here. So, the Freedom From Religion Foundation has expressed objection to the declaration of this month as the month of Ramadan in a letter asserting that the resolution violates the U.S. Constitution because it entangles the government with a specific religion. They say several statements from the Mecklenburg County Proclamation go beyond mere recognition of Ramadan as a cultural phenomenon because the resolution includes statements about drawing closer to God, which obviously the Freedom From Religion Foundation people don't believe in, revelations of the Prophet Muhammad, which are not possible because they don't believe in revelation, nor the notion of a prophet, and the existence of a soul, all without the qualification that these are mere beliefs of those who celebrate the holiday and not realities in and of themselves. Okay, so the strange bedfellow issue here is that conservative Christians would respond in the same way to the declaration of May 26th to June 30 being declared the month, or June 24 being declared the month of Ramadan. And so one of the guys who is a commissioner who voted against this, his name is Jim Puckett. He happens to be a Presbyterian. I happen to know him. He says this: to the best of my knowledge, we have never, and I don't think it would be proper, adopted a resolution in support of Lent, Easter, Christmas, Hanukkah, Passover, Yom Kippur, Pioneer Day for Mormons, or Diwali. He said that in an email to the Charlotte Observer, and I expect we're going to see a fair amount of back and forth on the subject of the declaration of this month being declared to be the month of Ramadan in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. Imagine there's going to be a brouhaha there on this subject for a while. So this will be a story that we'll watch. I want to lift up one other Ramadan story for you because it's on the subject of teaching tolerance, and it's posted by the Religion News Service. And the reason that I want to lift this up to you is that I think that everyone should be aware of, you know, the agendas that folks are advancing out there that are clearly religious but have an intersection with our local schools. Because that's what's going on here. This is an intersection of school and religion. So the story comes to us out of Huntington, New York, and it's a Reuters story, but it's posted by Religion News Service. So at a Roman Catholic high school in New York's Long Island suburbs, two dozen visiting Muslim students knelt and prayed, while teens in uniform blazers from the host school, which, by the way, is Roman Catholic, looked on. Now, I have to just go ahead and tell you right now that the reason that you need to go online and find this article on teaching tolerance to ease fears U.S. Muslim schools reach out to neighbors is because the pictures are worth a thousand words. To see Muslim students pictured under the cross that contains a crucifix is a pretty stunning visual. To see a photograph of students from the Islamic school participating in their daily prayers, they're kneeling, they're prostrate, their heads are bowed, their heads are covered. They are in what you would recognize as the traditional posture of Muslim prayer. And behind them in the photograph are all of these boys in, you know, button-down white shirts, ties, blue blazers. And it's like a weird show. So the article is interesting because the agenda is that there are going to be 70 school districts across the country where this exchange is slated to happen. 78 accredited or member schools located across 24 U.S. states are to arrange meetings between their own students and those at other non-Muslim schools. So this is going to be happening by the Council of Islamic Schools in North America. It may well be happening in a community near you. Here's what I'm most interested in. Because again, the pictures of these teenagers are worth a thousand words. I want access to the Snapchat. Because I don't care what these school districts have in mind is going to take place here with one group of teenagers acting out their religious faith in front of another group of teenagers. The Snapchat traffic is what you want to read. Because that's where you're going to see what's really going on conversationally among these students who live in the same community, worship in very different ways, go to very different schools, and my bet is talk very differently on Snapchat about what's going on than is being talked about by the RNS and the rest of us. Okay, one quick item of prayer before we go below the fold. Ma, I just want to lift up to you because we've talked about this issue before. You know that there are four Americans who have been interred in North Korea for various reasons. We have just learned that University of Virginia student Otto Warmbier, now we have talked about him before, we have just learned that he has been medically evacuated from North Korea in a coma. He's been detained for 17 months. You might remember that this young man took down a poster of Kim Jong-un, okay? Something you're not allowed to do. Now, he might have done it as a souvenir. He might have done it as an act of vandalism. But what he was charged with was an act against the state. And he got a 15-year sentence for hostile acts against the state. And he was going to spend those 15 years in hard labor. However, apparently what happened is more than a year ago, he contracted botulism, which is a potentially fatal disease caused by a toxin. And then they was given some kind of medication and has been in a coma for a year. So all we know really is that on June the 6th, North Korea's ambassador to the United Nations communicated that he was being released from North Korea. And what we know from his parents is that he was due to arrive home in Cincinnati on Tuesday evening after a stop at the U.S. military facility in Japan. So let's just be praying for this family. I can't imagine what it has been like for the last 17 months. I certainly can't imagine what it has been like for them since they found out that their son has been in a coma for most of that time. And I can't imagine what it's going to be like for them to receive his lifeless body home today. And so let's be praying for them. In the meantime, Dennis Rodman is on his way to North Korea as what I will describe as a diplomat who happens to have a personal relationship both with President Trump and Kim Jong-un. So we have a very unorthodox, unusual ambassador out there doing what, I don't exactly know. But at the same time, Dennis Rodman was traveling west Warmbier was traveling east. And so just want to lift up that family in prayer today. All right, high time to go below the fold. And this is what I want to lift up to you. In case you haven't seen it, it's absolutely worth a look. This was the over the weekend front page article in the USA Today, Womb with a View. Fetuses can recognize faces while still inside mom. Okay, first of all, hats off, my friends, to the USA Today for referring to a woman carrying a baby as a mom. Praise Jesus. Okay? Also, for the fact that, you know, the USA Today Weekend Edition, that's the issue of the paper that just sits around for 3 days. So hats off to them for having this kind of important pro-life article, which I'm sure is, you know, not the conversation in the editorial boardroom when they're picking articles, but hats off that that's what happened here. So however it is that this article ended up being in the weekend edition of the USA Today, I'm just thrilled that it's there. And I'm thrilled by the way the science in the article affirms life. Ultimately, there's no denying the reality that what is conceived in the womb of a woman is a sentient being that sees and hears and tastes and smells and feels, because after all, it's a baby. It's a baby, people. Okay, so if you haven't read it yet, go find it. Womb with a View. Fetuses can recognize faces while still inside mom. It's the outcome of a study in the UK, and it's cool to read. It will inspire you, and it will also break your heart in terms of the reality that all of those millions of American babies that we have been slaughtering over all these years could actually see and smell and taste and touch and feel in the womb. All right, so as a confirmation that God knows what's going on inside of the uterus and that God knows that person long before we may be recognizing their personhood, I give you Jeremiah chapter 1, verses 4 and 5. The word of the Lord came to me saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. I want you to consider that. Before God formed you in the womb, he knew you. You were known to him. You were a person known to God before you were a fetus in the womb. And then in Luke chapter 1, we get this powerful testimony about the recognition of Jesus by John. Now, these are two babies in two different wombs recognizing one another through the wall, through the belly. All right? So, I suppose the next study is going to be, not only is there facial recognition, but there is some kind of spiritual recognition going on here. Here's the text. In the sixth month, this is Luke chapter 1, picking up at verse 26. In the sixth month, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a town in Galilee, to a virgin pledged to be married to a man named Joseph, a descendant of David. The virgin's name was Mary. The angel went to her and said, "Greetings, you who are highly favored. The Lord is with you." Mary was greatly troubled at his words and wondered what kind of greeting this might be. The angel said, "Do not fear. Don't be afraid, Mary. You have found favor with God. You'll be with child. You'll give birth to a son. You are to give him the name Jesus. He will be great and be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. His kingdom will never end." Mary, stunned, asked, "How will this be, since I'm a virgin?" The angel answered, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you. The power of the Most High will overshadow you. So the Holy One will be called the Son of God." Now, even now, here's the kicker. Elizabeth, your relative, is going to have a child in her old age. She who was said to be barren is in her sixth month, for nothing is impossible with God. So you know the rest of the story. Mary rushes to see Elizabeth, and what happens? When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the baby leaped in her womb. Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit and declared, "Blessed are you, Mary, among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb." All right, friends, there's a recognition in the Bible of the personhood of the being in the womb. Let us follow that biblical mandate. Hey, this is The Reconnect. I'll see you back here right here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.